neighbors to leave it subject to be taxed by the latter. James Wilson dwelt on the injustice and impolicy of leaving New Jersey, Connecticut, etc., any longer subject to the exactions of their commercial neighbors. That the Commerce Clause was meant to remedy this mischief is clear. Madison stated that it was necessary to remove existing and injurious retaliations among the states, that the best guard against this abuse was the right in the general government to regulate trade between state and state. Roger Sherman stated that the oppression of the uncommercial states was guarded against by the power to regulate trade between the states. And Oliver Ellsworth said that the power of regulating trade between the states will protect them against each other. Given the jealous attachment to state sovereignty, the absence of objection that the Commerce Clause invaded state autonomy indicates that such an intrusion was simply unimaginable. Thomas Jefferson accurately reflected the founders' views when he stated in 1791 that the power given to Congress by the Constitution does not extend to the internal regulation of the commerce of a state, which remains exclusively with its own legislature, but to its external commerce only, that is to say, its commerce with another state or with foreign nations. That no more was intended was made clear by Madison in a letter to J.C. Cabell, among the several states, grew out of the abuses of the power by the importing states in taxing the non-importing, and was intended as a negative and preventive provision against injustice among the states themselves, rather than as a power to be used for the positive purposes of the general government. In 2001, Commerce Clause expert and Georgetown University law professor Randy E. Barnett undertook an extensive examination of the original meaning of the Constitution's Commerce Clause and the framers' intent. Having also returned to the Constitutional Convention and the Federalist Papers, as well as the state ratification debates, Barnett found that the term commerce was consistently used in the narrow sense, and that there is no surviving example of it being used in either source in any broader sense. The same holds true for the use of the word commerce in the Federalist Papers. Barnett wrote, "In Madison's notes for the Constitutional Convention, the term commerce appears 34 times in the speeches of the delegates. 8 of these are unambiguous references to commerce with foreign nations, which can only consist of trade. In every other instance, the terms trade or exchange could be substituted for the term commerce, with the apparent meaning of the statement preserved. In no instance is the term commerce clearly used to refer to any gainful activity or anything broader than trade." Barnett continued, "In none of the 63 appearances of the term commerce in the Federalist Papers is it ever used to unambiguously refer to any activity beyond trade or exchange." Furthermore, he wrote, "Having examined every use of the term commerce that appears in the reports of the state ratification conventions, I found that the term was uniformly used to refer to trade or exchange, rather than all gainful activity." In the end, writes Barnett, "if anyone in the Constitutional Convention or the state ratification conventions used the term commerce to refer to something more comprehensive than trade or exchange, they either failed to make explicit that meaning or their comments were not recorded for posterity." In 2002, the late constitutional scholar Robert H. Bork and attorney Daniel E. Troy, also examining the Constitution's Commerce Clause, explained, "Early American writings distinguish commerce from the class of subjects to which it is separate but connected in two ways, either by a direct discussion of what is excluded from commerce or by implication. Alexander Hamilton's writings in the Federalist Papers provide many of these definitions by implication. Hamilton often included commerce in a list of concepts which are similar in one way, activities critical to the success of the nation, for instance, but distinct enough to call for separate identification, as in the state of commerce, of arts, of industry. These early discussions of the nature of the Union suggest that commerce does not include manufacturing, agriculture, labor, or industry. In short, commerce does not seem to have been used during the founding era to refer to those acts that precede the act of trade. Interstate commerce seems to refer to interstate trade, that is, commerce is intercourse for the purposes of trade in any and all its forms, including the transportation, purchase, sale, and exchange of commodities between the citizens of different states. In fact, time and again, the framers made clear their intentions. In Federalist 42, Madison stated in part, "A very material object of this power was the relief of the states which import and export through other states from the improper contributions levied on them by the latter. Were these at liberty to regulate the trade between state and state, it must be foreseen that ways would be found out to load the articles of import and export, during the passage through their jurisdiction, with duties which would fall on the makers of the latter and the consumers of the former." In Federalist 45, Madison wrote famously that "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite." For the framers, promoting and securing commerce and trade were not matters of theoretical and academic debate, but national survival. They were addressing a dire problem that threatened the existence of the country following the Revolutionary War. The young nation was weak economically. The country barely survived war with one of the world's superpowers, Great Britain. The individual states had often functioned like individual countries and were given to frequent squabbles. Now the fledgling nation found itself surrounded by European powers in Canada, Florida, and Louisiana. In an age of mercantilism, Europe sought advantages in trade by excluding American businesses and promoting their own. The states themselves, although joined together in 1781 by the Articles of Confederation, sought to gain advantage over each other with tariffs and regulations. States even printed their own currency, which added to the confusion. It is difficult to see how America could have long survived under this type of system. Yet this was the state of American enterprise in the early days of the Republic. As Associate Justice Joseph Story observed, "It is hardly possible to exaggerate the oppressed and degraded state of domestic commerce, manufactures, and agriculture at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. Our ships were almost driven from the ocean. Our workshops were nearly deserted, our mechanics were in a starving condition, and our agriculture was sunk to the lowest ebb. These were the natural results of the inability of the general government to regulate commerce, so as to prevent the injurious monopolies and exclusions of foreign nations, and the conflicting and often ruinous regulations of the different states." Story's commentaries on the Constitution are considered some of the most significant early works on the subject. It is important to note that Story, although writing in the 1800s, used the language typical of the time of the Constitution's drafting and ratification. Commerce, manufacturing, and agriculture were separate and distinct areas of economic activity, as is plain from, among other things, their multiple references in the Federalist Papers. Commerce was not a catch-all to describe all three. If commerce was not agriculture or manufacturing, then it would indicate that the framers did not intend the federal government to regulate without severe and effective limits. The separation of the three concepts, in other words, indicates a significant and purposeful limitation to the commerce power. Indeed, commerce was so important in the early days that it was a catalyst for the Constitutional Convention. In 1786, Virginia invited the other states to a meeting in Annapolis, Maryland, to deal with commercial issues. That September, several delegates met but realized that commerce could not be separated from larger issues of governance. They called for another convention and returned to their states. Congress agreed, and of course, in 1787, representatives convened in Philadelphia at what would later be known as the Constitutional Convention. Madison, among others, had been troubled by the many deficiencies in the Articles of Confederation, including their detrimental effect on commerce. In 1787, he wrote a critique of the Articles, listing its many vices. Within a section focusing on trespasses of the states on the rights of each other, he identified how the individual states had been engaging in trade wars. The practice of many states in restricting the commercial intercourse with other states and putting their productions and manufactures on the same footing with those of foreign nations, though not contrary to the federal articles, is certainly adverse to the spirit of the Union, and tends to beget retaliating regulations, not less expensive and vexatious in themselves than they are destructive of the general harmony. States with navigable ports extracted taxes from adjoining states, whose merchants were exporting their goods to foreign markets. States taxed imported goods from other states, and in some instances, at rates even higher than foreign countries. In the preface to the debates, Madison laid the problem bare. The states having ports for foreign commerce taxed and irritated the adjoining states, trading through them, as New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and South Carolina. Some of the states, as Connecticut, taxed imports as from Massachusetts higher than imports even from Great Britain, of which Massachusetts complained to Virginia and doubtless to other states. In sundry instances of as New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, the navigation laws treated the citizens of other states as aliens. The Federalist Papers, designed to rally support behind state ratification, mentioned frequently the importance of a national commercial system without internal barriers. In Federalist 11, The Utility of the Union in Respect to Commercial Relations and a Navy, Alexander Hamilton wrote, "An unrestrained intercourse between the states themselves will advance the trade of each by an interchange of their respective productions, not only for the supply of reciprocal wants at home, but for exportation to foreign markets. The veins of commerce in every part will be replenished, and will acquire additional motion and vigor from a free circulation of the commodities of every part." A common thread in the critiques of the Articles of Confederation and the arguments in support of the Constitution is that the framers wanted to promote commerce. The Commerce Clause was the solution to a specific problem, the erection of trade barriers that threatened commerce and trade. The framers did not say that the Articles of Confederation were deficient because Congress lacked the power to set wages for workers or limit how much wheat a farmer could grow. If anyone suggested such a thing in Philadelphia, he might have been tarred and feathered. At the very least, the Commerce Clause would never have survived state ratification. Put another way, the framers did not empower the federal government, in small ways and large, to control the economy for whatever good and promised ends federal officials might proclaim. This understanding of the limited powers of the Commerce Clause was actually reflected in the decisions of the Supreme Court for most of our history, up to 1937. Although the court struggled with various factual scenarios in applying the clause and constructed different tests for that purpose, to its credit, the court mostly attempted to honor the text of the clause and the framers' intent. In 1824, the court first addressed the Commerce Clause in Gibbons v. Ogden. In that case, New York had granted exclusive navigation rights to its waterways to Robert R. Livingston and Robert Fulton for boats powered by fire or steam. Congress, however, had passed a law in 1793 regulating coastal trade. The court, under Chief Justice John Marshall, considered whether the power to regulate commerce included the power to regulate navigation. While holding that it did, Marshall noted that Congress could regulate navigation because all America has uniformly understood the word commerce to comprehend navigation. It was so understood and must have been so understood when the Constitution was framed. But the court also noted that this power to regulate commerce among the several states did not extend to purely internal commerce. Comprehensive as the word among is, it may very properly be restricted to that commerce which concerns more states than one. The genius and character of the whole government seem to be that its action is to be applied to all the external concerns of the nation and to those internal concerns which affect the states generally, but not to those which are completely within a particular state, which do not affect other states, and with which it is not necessary to interfere for the purpose of executing some of the general powers of the government. The completely internal commerce of a state, then, may be considered as reserved for the state itself. New York's attempt to grant a monopoly over navigation rights was struck down. The limitations on the Commerce Clause, acknowledged by Gibbons v. Ogden, were generally followed by the court for well over 100 years. Even during the earliest days of the New Deal, the Supreme Court acknowledged the limits the Commerce Clause placed on Congress and the President. Congress had passed a number of laws and established several new agencies that centralized within the federal government decision-making on a broad spectrum of economic matters, having nothing to do with commerce among the several states. In 1934, Congress passed the Railroad Retirement Act, which established compulsory retirement plans for railroad workers. The court invalidated it in 1935 because Congress had no constitutional authority to regulate a business relationship between employer and employee. The court wrote, "We feel bound to hold that a pension plan thus imposed is in no proper sense a regulation of the activity of interstate transportation. It is an attempt for social ends to impose by sheer fiat non-contractual incidents upon the relation of employer and employee, not as a rule of regulation or commerce or transportation between the states, but as a means of assuring a particular class of employees against old age dependency." Thereafter, the court struck down sections of the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 in the Schechter Poultry or Sick Chicken case, holding that the Commerce Clause did not empower Congress to enact a law setting wages and hours of poultry workers in Brooklyn, New York. The court also found that the chickens never left the state, writing in part, "So far as the poultry here in question is concerned, the flow in interstate commerce had ceased. The poultry had come to permanent rest within the state. It was held, used, or sold by defendants in relation to any further transaction in interstate commerce, and was not destined for transportation to other states." The court declared, "If the Commerce Clause were construed to reach all enterprises and transactions, which could be said to have an indirect effect upon interstate commerce, the federal authority would embrace practically all the activities of the people." In 1936, the court ruled that another New Deal law, the Bituminous Coal Conservation Act, was unconstitutional. The act created a national coal commission, as well as coal districts, and fixed coal prices, wages, hours, and working conditions of miners throughout the country. The court concluded, "Much stress is put upon the evils which come from the struggle between employers and employees over the matter of wages, working conditions, the right of collective bargaining, etc. And the resulting strikes, curtailment, and irregularity of production and effects on prices. And it is insisted that interstate commerce is greatly affected thereby. But, in addition to what has just been said, the conclusive answer is that the evils are all local evils, over which the federal government has no legislative control. President Franklin Roosevelt struck back. He threatened to pack the Supreme Court, and did, in fact, begin to change its makeup by replacing retiring justices with lawyers who shared his statist designs. It was not long before the court abruptly reversed course. It began with the 1937 decision in Jones v. Laughlin Steel Corporation, where the court ruled that intrastate activities that have a close and substantial relation to interstate commerce, such that their control is essential or appropriate to protect that commerce from burdens and obstructions, are within Congress's power to regulate. The legal stage was now set for a radical departure from the Constitution's Commerce Clause text and the framers' intent. The most infamous of the Court's New Deal decisions in this regard came in 1942, with its ruling in Wickard v. Filburn. In this case, the Court abandoned any semblance of jurisprudential integrity and joined with the rest of the federal government in unleashing what is today an endless array of federal interventions in private economic activity. The Wickard case involved a dairy farm in Ohio owned by Roscoe Filburn. He used a portion of his land to grow wheat. Every year, the wheat he produced was used in four ways. Some was sold, some was fed to his livestock, some was used to make flour, and the rest was used for seeding for the following year. The use or sale of his wheat all occurred exclusively within the state of Ohio. The Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, however, set quotas on the amount of wheat he was allowed to produce. When Filburn exceeded the quota, he was fined by the federal government. How could the federal government regulate wheat that was grown, used, and sold wholly within the borders of Ohio? The Supreme Court wrote, in part, "It can hardly be denied that a factor of such volume and variability as home-consumed wheat would have a substantial influence on price and market conditions. This may arise because, being in marketable condition, such wheat overhangs the market, and if induced by rising prices, tends to flow into the market and check price increases. But if we assume that it is never marketed, it supplied a need of the man who grew it, which would otherwise be reflected by purchases in the open market. Homegrown wheat, in this sense, competes with wheat in commerce. The stimulation of commerce is a use of the regulatory function quite as definitely as prohibitions or restrictions on them." If there was any doubt at all where the court was taking the nation, it added that, "even if appellee's activity be local, and though it may not be regarded as commerce, it may still, whatever its nature, be reached by Congress if it exerts a substantial economic effect on interstate commerce. Hence, non-commercial, local activity could be regulated by the federal government if it was said to have a substantial effect on commerce, even when it did not. Consequently, virtually any economic activity could be said to affect interstate commerce." For the last 70 years, since the Wickard decision, Congress passes laws and federal departments and agencies issue regulations affecting all manner of economic activity. Rather than promoting private commerce and trade without barriers between and among the states, which was the indisputable rationale for the Commerce Clause, the federal government now intervenes in private economic activity and stomps on state sovereignty at every turn. For example, in 1968, in Maryland v. Wirtz, the Supreme Court ruled that the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act applied to state-run hospitals, nursing care facilities, and schools because, labor conditions in schools and hospitals can affect commerce. It added that if Congress had a rational basis for enacting the law, the court would uphold it. In 1971, in Perez v. United States, the court upheld provisions of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, making loan sharking a federal offense, despite the fact that these activities occurred strictly at the local level. The court ruled, "Extortionate credit transactions, though purely intrastate, may, in the judgment of Congress, affect interstate commerce." In his loan dissent, Associate Justice Potter Stewart argued that, "Under the statute before us, a man can be convicted without any proof of interstate movement, of the use of the facilities of interstate commerce, or of facts showing that his conduct affected interstate commerce. I think the framers of the Constitution never intended that the national government might define as a crime and prosecute wholly local activity through the enactment of federal criminal laws. With rare exceptions, the court has generally held that any federal law could affect commerce and would be constitutionally sustained if Congress provides a rational basis for a given law's impact on interstate commerce. Of course, most laws are based on some rational basis. Otherwise, they would be irrational. That is a very low bar indeed. In fact, there have only been two clear instances since Wickard where the Supreme Court has actually rejected Congress's attempt to further expand its power through the Commerce Clause. In 1995, in U.S. v. Lopez, Congress attempted to make the possession of a firearm near a school a federal crime with the Gun-Free Schools Zone Act of 1990. Proponents of the measure argued, among other things, that the inherent dangers of guns would increase insurance costs or deter travel, or that guns near schools would have a detrimental effect on education, a necessary foundation of commercial and economic activity. The court found these arguments beyond the reach of the Commerce Clause. As Chief Justice William Rehnquist wrote, the possession of a firearm near a school did not meet even the court's extremely broad view of commerce, which he summarized as follows. First, Congress may regulate the use of the channels of interstate commerce. Second, Congress is empowered to regulate and protect the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, or persons or things in interstate commerce, even though the threat may come only from intrastate activities. Finally, Congress's commerce authority includes the power to regulate those activities having a substantial relation to interstate commerce, i.e., those activities that substantially affect interstate commerce. Notably, even when drawing a line against Congress's power grab, Rehnquist embraced the court's earlier distortion of the Commerce Clause in Wickard. Moreover, consider Associate Justice Stephen Breyer's outlook in his dissent. Congress obviously could have thought that guns and learning are mutually exclusive. Congress could therefore have found a substantial educational problem, teachers unable to teach, students unable to learn, and concluded that guns near schools contribute substantially to the size and scope of that problem. Having found that guns in schools significantly undermine the quality of education in our nation's classrooms, Congress could also have found, given the effect of education upon interstate and foreign commerce, that gun-related violence in and around schools is a commercial as well as human problem. Education, although far more than a matter of economics, has long been inextricably intertwined with the nation's economy. For Breyer, there simply are no real limits on Congress's power to intervene in private economic behavior. Of course, state and local governments have the authority to outlaw gun possession near schools, and often do. But Breyer was not alone. Associate Justice David Souter considered the court's pre-1937 efforts to comply with the Commerce Clause's text and history The old judicial pretension that was discredited and abandoned, from which the court extricated itself almost 60 years ago by discarding its untenable jurisprudence. Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy, although concurring with the court's holding, wrote that stare decisis, the court's precedent, counsels us not to call into question the essential principles now in place. It forecloses us from reverting to an understanding of commerce that would serve only an 18th-century economy. Consequently, Souter rejected flatly what he knew to be the unequivocal intention of the framers when fashioning the Commerce Clause, and Kennedy determined that the only judicial precedents worthy of faithful adherence were Commerce Clause opinions the court began issuing in 1937. As for economic growth necessitating the rewrite of the Commerce Clause, Raoul Berger noted that these justices too easily assume that economic growth necessarily is accompanied by automatic expansion of the Constitution to facilitate it. Economic expansion, however, cannot alter the scope of the fixed Constitution, particularly when the alteration constitutes a federal takeover of functions that the states were assured were inviolable. In fact, the Industrial Revolution in the United States predated the New Deal, turning the nation into the most powerful economic force on earth and creating a vast middle class. The second case, United States versus Morrison, came in 2000 and involved the Violence Against Women Act of 1994, which created a federal cause of action for victims of gender-based violence. If upheld, Congress would have assumed police powers belonging to the states and localities, and the authority to federalize virtually any criminal activity. However, the court found the link between the statute and interstate commerce too ephemeral. Rehnquist wrote, "We accordingly reject that argument that Congress may regulate non-economic, violent criminal conduct based solely on that conduct's aggregate effect on interstate commerce. The Constitution requires a distinction between what is truly national and what is truly local." In his dissent, Breyer noted correctly that the court had not rejected its post-1937 precedent, but he complained that it had not expanded that precedent far enough. The court's rules, even if broadly interpreted, are under-inclusive. The local pickpocket is no less a traditional subject of state regulation than is the local gender-motivated assault. Regardless, the court reaffirms, as it should, Congress's well-established and frequently exercised power to enact laws that satisfy a commerce-related jurisdictional prerequisite. For example, that some item relevant to the federally regulated activity has at some time crossed a state line. And, in a world where most everyday products or their component parts cross interstate boundaries, Congress will frequently find it possible to redraft a statute using language that ties the regulation to the interstate movement of some relevant object, thereby regulating local criminal activity, or for that matter, family affairs. The ruling did not slow Congress's march for ever more authority to control economic activity and the states. And, as Breyer suggested, Congress would move to regulate family matters. Most recently and notoriously, in its Obamacare decision, 4 of the 9 Supreme Court justices were prepared to use the Commerce Clause to uphold a provision in the law, the so-called individual mandate, penalizing individuals who refuse to engage affirmatively in an economic transaction against their wishes and/or interests, that is, the purchase of a private health care policy. As written, Obamacare imposes a penalty on those uninsured individuals who do not purchase health insurance. These 4 justices would have upheld the law on Commerce Clause grounds, insisting that a decision by an individual not to take any action affects interstate commerce. In a 4-justice concurring opinion, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote, "The decision to forego insurance is hardly inconsequential or equivalent to doing nothing. It is instead an economic decision Congress has the authority to address under the Commerce Clause. It would seem the nation is one Supreme Court justice away from the federal government dictating all manner of individual behavior. Lest we forget, the Supreme Court is ruling on laws passed by Congress and regulations issued by the executive branch. Since 1937, all three branches of the federal government have colluded openly in dismantling the Constitution's structure. The governing masterminds, elected and appointed, have bulldozed through the enumeration of powers, separation of powers, and the state's sovereignty to regulate and control private economic activity, and more. The rewriting of the Constitution without benefit of constitutional amendment is behavior that is, by definition, unconstitutional. The proposed amendment returns the power to regulate commerce and trade to one of defined parameters. It not only encourages commerce and trade between and among the states, but, as the framers understood and intended, also preserves the civil society and promotes individual liberty. This is a hugely significant matter. As Dr. Milton Friedman explained, freedom in economic arrangements is itself a component of freedom broadly understood, so economic freedom is an end in itself. Economic freedom is also an indispensable means toward the achievement of political freedom. Chapter 8. An Amendment to Protect Private Property. Section 1. When any governmental entity acts not to secure a private property right against actions that injure property owners, but to take property for a public use from a property owner by actual seizure or through regulation, which taking results in a market value reduction of the property, interference with the use of the property, or a financial loss to the property owner exceeding $10,000, the government shall compensate fully said property owner for such losses. Influenced by luminaries such as John Locke and William Blackstone, the founders understood that the fundamental right to own and maintain property was an essential element in a functioning civil society. In The Second Treatise of Government, which was hugely popular during the American founding and heavily relied on by Thomas Jefferson in drafting the Declaration of Independence, Locke asserted, "The government cannot take from any man any part of his property without his own consent. For the preservation of property being the end of government, and that for which men enter into society, it necessarily supposes and requires that the people should have property, without which they must be supposed to lose that by entering into society, which was the end for which they entered into it, too gross an absurdity for any man to own." In his celebrated Commentaries on the Laws of England, Blackstone also extols the right to property. "So great is the regard of the law for private property that it will not authorize the least violation of it, no, not even for the general good of the whole community. If a new road, for instance, were to be made through the grounds of a private person, it might perhaps be extensively beneficial to the public. But the law permits no man or set of men to do this without consent of the owner of the land." Blackstone added that the public good is in nothing more essentially interested than in the protection of every individual's private right, as modeled by the municipal law. Owning and preserving property free from oppressive government intrusion serves as one of the fundamental building blocks for a prosperous republic. James Madison noted, "Government is instituted no less for protection of property than of the persons, of individuals." In short, property rights are unalienable rights. The rights of property are committed into the same hands with the personal rights. Some attention ought, therefore, to be paid to property in the choice of those hands. Governor Morris, a widely influential founder, observed that enshrining property rights in a civil society was a necessary antecedent to any concept of a functioning community. Without society, property in goods is extremely precarious. There is not even the idea of property in lands. Like Madison, Morris believed that an elemental purpose of any government was the preservation of property. Conventions to defend each other's goods naturally apply to the defense of those places where the goods are deposited. The object of such conventions must be to preserve for each his own share. Thus, property is the principal cause and object of society. George Mason declared in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, the precursor to the Declaration of Independence, that all men are by nature equally free and independent, and have certain inherent rights, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property. Perhaps John Adams put it best when he wrote, "Suppose a nation, rich and poor, high and low, 10 millions in number, all assembled together. Not more than 1 or 2 millions will have lands, houses, or any personal property. If we take into the account the women and children, or even if we leave them out of the question, a great majority of every nation is wholly destitute of property, except a small quantity of clothes and a few trifles of other movables. Would Mr. Nedham be responsible that, if all were to be decided by a vote of the majority, the 8 or 9 millions who have no property would not think of usurping over the rights of the 1 or 2 millions who have? Property is surely a right of mankind as really as liberty. Perhaps, at first, prejudice, habit, shame or fear, principle or religion would restrain the poor from attacking the rich, and the idle from usurping on the industrious. But the time would not be long before courage and enterprise would come, and pretexts be invented by degrees to countenance the majority in dividing all the property among them, or at least in sharing it equally with its present possessors. Debts would be abolished first, taxes laid heavy on the rich and not at all on the others, and at last a downright equal division of everything be demanded and voted. What would be the consequence of this? The idle, the vicious, the intemperate would rush into the utmost extravagance of debauchery, sell and spend all their share, and then demand a new division of those who purchased from them. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. If "thou shalt not covet" and "thou shalt not steal" were not commandments of heaven, they must be made inviolable precepts in every society before it can be civilized or made free. The right to private property, that is, the fruits of an individual's physical and intellectual labor, was known to be a keystone to a free society's foundation. It is a natural right, protected by natural law. In this there was no divergence between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. Given the primacy of property rights, the framers insisted that certain safeguards should be incorporated in the Constitution to protect against excessive government intrusion. Therefore, as part of the Bill of Rights, the Fifth Amendment provides explicitly, "Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation." Referred to in legal circles as the Takings Clause, this provision obligates the government to compensate the property owner when the government takes private property for some putative public good. However, much debate surrounds the issue of what actually constitutes a taking. Those who insist on the all-encompassing power of government claim a taking only occurs when the government physically seizes property. Those who, like the founders, extol the indispensable value of property rights in preserving a civil society, recognize that a taking also occurs when the government, by an act of Congress, state legislature, or administrative regulation, effectively destroys or substantially diminishes the market value of private property. These regulatory takings, as they are called, are often indistinguishable from actual physical takings. These types of governmental actions may not constitute an actual physical appropriation of property. Instead, they impose significant restrictions on the owner's use of the property. Consequently, the property owner can suffer severe economic damages should the restriction prevent the economic development or private use of the property. Again, the framers placed the highest importance on property rights, which they sought to protect from the government they were establishing. They would not have cared which branch of the federal government confiscated private property or whether it was confiscated outright or by way of diminished value or use. For the framers, private property was inviolable, protected explicitly in the Fifth Amendment. Today, the Supreme Court, endlessly seeking ways to reinforce, if not promote, the growing powers of the federal government, and especially the extensive and growing tentacles of the administrative state, discounts both the nation's history and heritage. It has limited severely the factors that constitute a regulatory taking and justify compensating the property owner. The court has issued a host of opinions addressing the application of the takings clause. In 1922, Associate Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. first recognized a regulatory taking in Pennsylvania Coal versus Mahan. He wrote, "While property may be regulated to a certain extent, if regulation goes too far, it will be recognized as a taking." The imprecise standard of too far has confounded subsequent courts, which have attempted to apply a jumbled mass of tests and factors to determine whether a taking has occurred. The court has said that in certain limited instances, a regulatory taking will be considered a taking for purposes of the Fifth Amendment, and the owner will be awarded just compensation. In cases where there is a deprivation of all economically beneficial use of a property, the court has acknowledged that the Fifth Amendment mandates that the property owner be awarded just compensation. In these cases, the regulation has made the property completely worthless. For partial regulatory takings, instances where the regulation only partially affects the value of the property, the outcome is not so certain. In 1978, in Pennsylvania Central Transportation Company versus New York City, the court wrote that there is no set formula for determining whether a partial regulatory taking merits compensation, but there are factors that have particular significance. These factors include the economic impact of the regulation, particularly the extent to which the regulation has interfered with distinct investment-backed expectations. In 1992, in Lucas versus South Carolina Coastal Council, even Associate Justice Antonin Scalia indicated that a regulation devaluing a property of 95% of its value may not constitute a taking, and the property owner would not necessarily be eligible for compensation. In 1993, in Concrete Pipe and Productions of California versus Construction Laborers Pension Trust for Southern California, the court held that the mere diminution in the value of property, however serious, is insufficient to demonstrate a taking. It is not enough for a property's value to decrease as a result of the regulation. The owner must pass some convoluted test to establish a regulatory taking. In 2005, in Lingle v. Chevron USA Incorporated, The court said it would also consider the character of the governmental action, whether the regulatory taking amounts to a physical invasion or instead merely affect property interests through some public program. These tortured rationales and unnecessarily complex tests discount a seminal and underlying principle of property rights. That is, the right to own and control one's property is a natural, fundamental right that should receive the highest level of legal protection. The burden should not fall to the individual to justify the government intrusion as one that meets a series of complicated and incoherent tests to qualify as a taking. Rather, the burden should be on the government to justify the appropriation as one necessary for the public interest. Then the onus rests with the government to compensate the individual for the negative economic effect the burden places on the owner's property interest. This is not to confuse the government's role in preserving private property rights under its police powers with a taking. Well before the adoption of our Constitution, it was understood that one neighbor did not have a right to interfere with the ownership and use of another neighbor's property. For example, a property owner upstream does not have a right to use his property in a way that pollutes a stream flowing through the land of a property owner downstream, thereby destroying or diminishing the value of the downstream property. As such, the government is exercising its authority to protect private property rights, which also serves the societal good, not expand its power to confiscate or control private property for some asserted governmental purpose. In the late 1980s, President Ronald Reagan issued Executive Order 12630, requiring federal agencies to consider the taking implications when an agency promulgated new regulations. The order was needed to protect public funds by minimizing government intrusion upon private property rights and to budget for the payment of just compensation when such intrusions were inevitable. Although a noble acknowledgement of the importance of property rights, Executive Order 12630 lacked any enforcement mechanisms. That is, it did not provide a cause of action. Consequently, property owners could not use the agency finding in proving their claim that federal government action was considered a taking. It is indicative that so extensive is the government's taking practices that there is no reliable calculation on its aggregate costs to society. Either its costs to property owners or the costs to government in those relatively limited cases in which it actually compensates property owners. Meanwhile, there is no question that regulatory takings are swelling as government itself swells. The proposed amendment does a number of things. It acknowledges the crucial distinction between the government exercising its legitimate police powers to protect private property rights and its obligation to compensate property owners when government action, whether a statute, administrative regulation, or executive order, interferes with the ownership and use of private property for an asserted public interest. If the government action serves a public interest, then the public must assume responsibility for the cost and compensate the property owner who suffers a loss in excess of $10,000. The proposed amendment will force the government to make more extensive and comprehensive cost-benefit calculations when exercising its legal authority, given that the cost burden shifts from the individual to the government. Moreover, the proposed amendment creates an expanded legal basis for private property owners to assert a constitutionally acknowledged and protected right. The notion that a taking must be physical, total, or near total to trigger a just compensation defies the framers' intent and the Fifth Amendment's purpose. It also renders moot the convoluted precedents and ad hoc tests promulgated by the Supreme Court and instead establishes a more stable and predictable legal environment for property owners and users. Finally, the proposed amendment is not limited to takings by the federal government. It applies to all levels of government. While I acknowledge that the state legislatures themselves will undoubtedly determine the scope of this proposed amendment, or one similar in purpose, if and when they decide to appoint delegates to attend a convention, I would encourage them to control their own abuses of state citizens. When an individual's property is diminished or devalued by government action, the individual does not much care which level of government is responsible for violating his property rights. After all, the right to own property and use it was so important that the states themselves insisted on making the protection unambiguous by incorporating the Takings Clause in the Fifth Amendment. Chapter 9. An Amendment to Establish How the States May Amend the Constitution. Section 1. The state legislatures, whenever two-thirds shall deem it necessary, may adopt amendments to the Constitution. Section 2. Each state legislature adopting said amendments must adopt amendments identical in subject and wording to the other state legislatures. Section 3. A 6-year time limit is placed on the adoption of an amendment, starting from the date said amendment is adopted by the first state legislature. Each state legislature adopting said amendment shall provide an exact copy of the adopted amendment, along with an affidavit signed and dated by the Speaker of the state legislature, to the Archivist of the United States within 15 calendar days of its adoption. Section 4. Upon adoption of an amendment, the state legislature may not rescind the amendment or modify it during the 6-year period in which the amendment is under consideration by the several states' legislatures. As discussed earlier, Article 5 of the Constitution sets forth the two processes for amending the Constitution. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. As the text and history make clear, the amendment processes are difficult. A supermajority of two-thirds of the members of both houses of Congress is required to propose amendments, or two-thirds of the state legislatures are required to call for a convention to amend the Constitution, which means 34 states. Moreover, three-fourths of the states, or 38 states, must ratify the proposed amendments, either by votes of the state legislatures or state conventions, for them to be incorporated into the Constitution. The level of complexity in the amendment processes was intentional. The framers envisioned a clear and specific purpose for the system of government they established. The Constitution was not meant to be a detailed list of laws and edicts to micromanage people's behavior. It was not meant to change with factional or majoritarian impulses. And it was not meant to serve the political expedience of a class of governing masterminds and their fanatical followers. The Constitution's authors intended it to serve as a steady, reliable, and not easily altered apparatus of governance in perpetuity, or at least as long as a people would covet liberty, built upon unalienable rights by which a huge, diverse,